Do you meet the last week of class?
Yeah.
I think it's highly likely. I don't think I did change anything. Okay. Sorry for the crazy start. End to a crazy day. All right. Welcome to Conceptual Foundations. Going to do a couple of things today. I'm going to tell you about me, about the course, about sort of the mechanics. I know there's shoppers in here, so we'll see what questions you have about the class. But then given away all my copies, and I have one, Josh, then we're actually going to talk about the conceptual, what'd you say? Syllabus, I think I have. Thank you. Then we're going to talk about the conceptual foundations of bioethics. So we're going to just dig right in and get to it. So by the end of today, I will have given you a sketch of what I consider the conceptual foundations of bioethics. This is not a particularly controversial framework for thinking about how moral frameworks work, but I will always add where I think I've gone off the rails a little bit, or where I'm pretty standard, or where bioethicists differ. But in general, this is a fairly accepted understanding of the conceptual foundations of bioethics in the world of philosophy and, to some extent, bioethics, that is, philosophical bioethics. But never mind all that. You'll have a first-pass sketch through, and then the rest of the semester will be working through each of these components. The general idea of the class is this. I'm going to argue, as moral philosophers do, that people reason from one of two vantage points. They either reason morally, work through problems morally, from a principle-based understanding of duties, obligations, moral considerations, or they reason in a very risk-benefit kind of analysis, a very consequentialist or utilitarian mode. And depending on which of those two frameworks you utilize as you work through a moral problem, you will make certain kinds of assumptions. You'll have certain types of strengths in the moral reasoning that you use. You'll have certain types of vulnerabilities. And so will the person who's arguing opposite you. And to understand how that works gives us a deeper understanding of the argument that you're looking at. For example, we ought to allow stem cell research. We ought not to allow stem cell research. It'll give you a deeper understanding of the argument you're reading to know, is this person pro-stem cell research because she is a deontologist or because she's a utilitarian? Knowing that, either want to bolster that argument and support it, or because you want to attack it and refute it, either way, knowing how those arguments work will empower you to be more effective in the way that you look at the arguments. It'll also help you strengthen your own moral reasoning to examine the presuppositions that you hold when you confront a moral problem. So the strategy of the class is to get a very profound understanding of the framework in its theoretical form. I didn't mean you had to sit there. I'm sorry. My pointing is not effective. Okay, no, that's okay. I apologize. I'm going to put in some more effective mode of sign language. Okay. The first form will be the theoretical, so you understand how deontology and utilitarianism works, and then we'll apply it. So you can see, well, what does it look like when one is a consequentialist and approaching a particular problem? So the mastery of that is really the first half of the class. The second half, and I'm going to go into much more detail in a second, just giving you the overview. The second half of the class is to look at theoretical aspects to bioethics that don't fit into that framework, that do something different. So these are two kinds of apples. We'll look at an orange. And we'll look at a bioethical version of an apple, for example. I'm going to tell you in more concrete terms what that means. But in the second half, we're going to look more specifically at the theoretical terrain of bioethics proper. In the first half, we're really in moral philosophy, which was co-opted, basically, taken from bioethics, which is why on your little cheat sheet you have part one, which are the moral theories that are borrowed by bioethics, and the second half of the class, those that are created or resurrected by bioethics. And that is going to give us, I think, a good picture of what the conceptual terrain in bioethics looks like. So stay tuned for more of that in a couple of minutes. We just want to walk through some of the nitty-gritty. It can sound a little bit of, well, it can sound quite dull to think that we're going to spend so much time theoretically when you are in bioethics mostly because you like the juicy controversies of bioethics. But I can assure you this class is anything but dull. To watch how philosophy actually comes alive in the arguments you care about is actually really engaging, even if you've never had a philosophy class, which most of you can say. That is, almost none of you have had a philosophy class in your past experience, at least if you're like any other section of conceptual foundations. There is no assumption of any philosophical background, but if you have a strong philosophical background, it'll be very enhancing for us. And I think you'll look at all of these problems in a very different way. But I will say, just by the title of the class, early on, before I had convinced our fearless leader, Art Kaplan, that this was really going to be a great class, he nicknamed it the Pathan Death March. But it will not feel like that to you, I swear. In fact, it's my favorite class, and it's usually the class that, at least of the ones I teach, usually gets the highest marks. So sounds a little bit odd going in, but let's see what you think at the end of today's session when I actually go through and talk about each of these things. Okay, so I didn't tell you who I was because I know most of you, but I'm Autumn Feaster. I direct the Master of Bioethics program, and I am the Associate Director of Penn's Center for Bioethics. And I am a moral philosopher, if that wasn't already clear to you. I work in clinical ethics. I co-direct the Penn Mediation Project, which actually starts an intensive mediation workshop tomorrow. And I encourage you to, if you do anything clinically related at all, I encourage you to take those workshops at some point in your time at Penn, because they are really practice-altering the skill set that we help you get to navigate bedside conflicts. Is really invaluable. But I co-direct the Penn Mediation Project with Ed Bergman. He's one of the co-teachers of this intensive. And then I co-direct the Bioethics, Sexuality, and Gender Identity Project with Lance Whalert. I had to cross him out because I don't want you to confuse the two of us and think I'm him. But so I also work in the area of LGBT, or what we call queer bioethics. Okay, that is me. Let's go through in rapid pace the nitty-gritty of the class, so we can do some substantive work today before we leave. Many of you have had me at least once, and some of you twice, and God forbid, thrice before. But for those of you who haven't, I'm going to have to go through that and all of the nitty-gritties about office hours and stuff. So if you're a veteran, I apologize, and you can now tune out for like the next half hour. Okay, first of all, the class is 4:30 to 6:30. It ends at 6:30. I always synchronize to the clock. I'm always on time, except for today, where I was 3 minutes late, according to the clock. And we will end on the dot. And that is so that you can go home and have dinner, or whatever it is you do, and not pal around and whatever and have to suffer longer. So in and out, 2 hours. That means there's no break. No break to do anything. No break to go have coffee and go to the bathroom and all of that formally built into the class. But the whole program, the Master of Bioethics program, and every elective we offer has the hallmark of flexibility. And that means that you can walk out of the class anytime you want for coffee and bathroom. I'm just not going to stop the class for it. So please feel free. There are two silver rings in the slot that has our course listings. If you don't have a black access key to use the bathrooms in the suite, then you'll take those keys and walk down this hall, and at the end of it you'll take a right, and that's where the bathrooms are. So silver keys, end of the hall, bathrooms on the right. Bring them back, because otherwise the next person can't go, right? So men's and women's room back there. Coffee, tea, cocoa is when, instead of going right to the bathroom, go left at the end of the hall, and there's a grad student lounge there. And inside the grad student lounge, you'll see a big chalkboard wall and a lot of movie posters. And if you just go in a little further, that's where we have our Keurig coffee machine, and you're entitled to that by taking the class. So help yourself and avoid supporting Starbucks, and it's all good. Not to pick on your Irwin or anything like that. But you are welcome to free coffee and tea as much as you want. Leave and come as you wish, and all the information is there. Being late to the class, despite the fact that I have obviously a deep commitment to punctuality, is not necessary. Many of you are even, you know, fixing people and helping others until 5 o'clock. You'll be late, I understand that. Don't apologize, and for God's sake, don't write to me about it. So just come when you come and leave when you leave and take breaks when you want to, but I will be here 4:30 to 6:30. Don't have a lot of time afterwards to chat because this gender and sexuality project that I run on my second shift. So I start around 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I'm here till 1:30 in the morning, 3 days a week, to run that program in the second shift, because I do this job in my day job, so I have to sort of dash so that I'm not here till 2. So my goal is always to be out of Penn by 1:30 in the morning. I feel like that's got to be everybody's goal. So, but I am very easy to get a hold of besides after class. So when you want to see me, just email me directly, and my email is at see. She's already taking my advice. Did you see that? It's perfect. That's when you know you're getting through to people. You can call me, but my voicemail just goes to the computer anyway, so email is really the best way, and that's a good way for me to keep track. Either way, it doesn't matter. But I have a very quick turnaround with email. In fact, I've gotten a lot worse, says my family, and a lot better, says you all, now that I am iPhone prepared, and I am never without it. In fact, right now, I haven't been able to check it for like 10 minutes. I don't know who's been emailing me. It's killing me. Okay. Really horrible. Paul and I actually both sleep with the BlackBerry and the iPhone in the bed. It is sick. So you will be able to get a hold of me via email quite easily. Okay. I keep my own appointments unless there's some task, like if you were in the fall class, there's a time when we do an outline and 94 people need to get to see me in a very short amount of time, and then my assistant Robin helps me schedule. But when we're not doing that, and we don't tend to do that in conceptual foundations, you want to just email me directly. I'll write back. We'll find a time that's good for you. I don't do appointments. I don't do office hours. I do personal appointments because you're never free when the office hours are, so I just sit there and then, you know, there's a whole line and whatever. So you get your own personal appointment, and I am at Penn 3 days a week. I work from home in Princeton too, but I can usually get you in within a couple of days or right away if it's a crisis. Okay. My administrative assistant is Robin Hartley. She's the student service coordinator for the master's program. So if you are in the program or interested in the program, you'll be interacting with her a lot. She's fabulous, and she keeps me totally on the ball and organized. She will be the person that you send everything to that is written. When you want to see me for an appointment, you write to me. But when it's time to hand in papers, you send to her. Partly that's because this is a very large class. You probably can't tell because Thursday is always smaller than Tuesday, and it's a combination class. You know, I think about conceptual foundations as both sections together, and I'll talk to you about how Tuesday and Thursday work, because I haven't said that yet, and I want to. But when it all gets together, it could be as big as 60, 70 people. And so when they're all handing papers in at once, I have really bad wrists. It's a lot of printing, and do I have enough paper and staple? And in addition, she keeps track. She keeps track of when you submit it, and she gives you a return receipt, and so everything you want to go through her when it comes to the written work. All right, let me talk about the Tuesday-Thursday deal. You are probably all signed up for Thursday, but let that not confine you to showing up on Thursdays. That registration of Tuesday or Thursday is not a choice you're held to. You can come any Tuesday or any Thursday, and that's why when you look at this syllabus, it's so convoluted. In fact, at times it gets downright convoluted, and we're going to walk it through week by week because it is very easy to make the mistake of showing up on a Tuesday and then a following Thursday and actually get the same lecture, because depending on the colloquium and other things like fall break that interfere, Martin Luther King and who knows what, the syllabus can get off between the two sections. But that should not stop you from deciding that this week it's just not convenient to come on Thursday and I want to come on Tuesday. You just need to use your syllabus wisely to figure out when we're doing what. So you do not, absolutely do not tell me that you're going to flip and come Tuesday next time. except you don't want to come next Tuesday unless you want to hear this spiel again. But in general, if you want to come on a Tuesday, feel free to mix and match as much as you want. There is no, I have no concern about that. We do the exact same thing in the Tuesday and Thursday, so they are mix or match. Doesn't matter what you're registered for, so feel completely flexible about this class. In fact, this is the class that most people shop when they're shopping in the spring, and part of the reason they do that is because it has this incredible flexibility, as does the fall required class. Okay, so that's the Tuesday, Thursday thing. Let's talk about the colloquium for a second. On February 15th, that's the Tuesday. Do we have a Thursday? That's a Tuesday. I think we only have one. Oh, no, and then we have April 7th. Yeah, okay. We have a big name speaker series, as does almost, you know, every center department, of course, in the world. But ours is done in a with a particular strategy in mind. Namely, it's our view that when you pay for classes and you're part of the course itself, you're also part of the colloquium series. So that I run the colloquium series, I pick the folks, and I get a lot of feedback from students and faculty about who to bring, but this really is a hit parade in bioethics. And so we are making a statement by plugging a colloquium into the class itself that this is really important to go to. So if you are a Thursday attender, then the April 7th colloquium with Cindy Patton is something we expect you to attend. And if you're a Tuesday attender, we would expect you to be at the John Robertson talk instead of class on Tuesday. The colloquium are here, and they're at the exact same time, 4:30, so it's not like you're doing anything extra. But we're not thinking of it as a week off, and we would like you to not think of it as a week off. Because you're in the class that you're taking, not just for the particular topic area, but because you're trying to get exposure. And so, as I said, we picked the absolute, you know, it's blue ribbon. John Robertson, for example, was on, Obama, Clinton's presidential commission. We have brought people from Bush's presidential commission. Half a pen is on Obama's commission, so we're not bringing them because they work here. But you know what I'm saying. Cindy Patton is one of the most famous queer studies people in North America. She's a Canadian. We only pick the absolute spectacular, you know, hit parade, so we expect you to be there on the day that you would normally attend class. So that's the colloquium. Of course, that said, we do this because we think it's a service to students. That said, it does interrupt the flow of a class that has a Tuesday and Thursday component. It doesn't matter if the class only meets on Monday, but when you have some people taking Tuesday and some on Thursday, you have to have a syllabus that looks as crazy as this one, because of course I got to map it up and try to keep us on target. Now, in some moments, because of this strange thing, we're going to get fairly off. Actually, I kind of adjusted it so it wasn't as off. I've had times when the Tuesday, Thursday could be off by like 3 weeks until we catch up, and that's not good, especially because the papers, which I'll talk about, are very much connected to the class. And when would that statement be false? I'm in a transplantation class, but I'm writing on vaccines. Of course the paper is connected to the class. It's been a very long day. What I mean is the papers are connected to the work we're doing in class. They are the kind of papers you would have done when you were in your sophomore year of college and you were being handheld, I'm sorry to tell you. But Conceptual Foundations has a very heavy instructor hand to it because there's a lot of material to absorb, and this is not the moment to go off and be a philosopher. This is dense, tough material that I'm walking you through, and the papers are really you reflecting back that, oh yes, you actually did get it. So what's important for these papers, and I'll talk about that, is that you actually come to class. Now, if you can't come to class, you can still come to class, because of course that's what this gadget is. 6 years now, I can't figure the thing out. Every Conceptual Foundations class is taped, unless I've screwed it up so badly. Make sure you take the stuff on the chair. Unless I've screwed it up so badly that I miss a class, but then it doesn't matter because guess what? I have another shot at it because I teach this class twice in a week. So therefore, it is the case. See how this wonderful argument works? It is always the case that a session will be taped of Conceptual Foundations. I give you this advice on the first day. You need to come to the class or you need to listen to the tape, especially in the first half, because the midterm will be excruciating if you haven't come to class. Now, if you have come to class, the midterm is going to feel like, my God, are we in undergrad? And I'm sorry about that, and yet I'm happy about that. What I want is for everyone to nail the midterm. And I see it as my job in the first half of the class to get the material across to you in a way that you are going to absolutely find this thing very straightforward. And yet we will find that the people who skip 70% of the classes will not find it actually an easy midterm. So if you come, it will be. And if you don't, or you don't make up the lectures, it could be very, very hard. So, and the thing is, there's really no faking it. Like, it's very straightforward, but you can't fake knowing what Kant is saying, or utilitarian. You just can't. And I can tell right away, so it's really bad. I can even tell when, which just happened to me, and it's somebody who handed the paper in a couple of years late, so you don't know this person, but I can even tell when a phrase is so not what someone who's learned what Kant would say, you know, it's not what a student of Kant would say, it's what Kant himself would say. And so, in fact, I can even pick out that this sentence must have been pulled directly, without quotation marks, from Kant himself, because no student could imitate Kant compellingly like this. This is Kant. Oh, put it in the browser. Indeed, Metaphysics of Morals, page 42. I can tell when you don't know what you're talking about, and I can tell when you're ripping Kant off and not putting quote marks. You have to come to class or listen to the class to actually nail the midterm. That is a true story. I actually had somebody plagiarize Kant handing a paper in 2 years late just a week ago. It was astounding. Okay, so obviously I'm still processing that because it wasn't that great an anecdote, but it's obviously on my mind. So when you're trying to figure out Tuesday versus Thursday, you want to look carefully at the syllabus to make sure that you're attending on the right day. You will notice as well that one time we just have to have no class. February 10th on a Thursday, I tried everything I could do to not cut a Thursday class given what was going on in the Tuesday section, and I just couldn't do it. I tried every iteration, and finally February 10th, done. So I'm sorry about that. That makes it even between the Tuesday and the Thursday class. Penn is odd in this spring semester where different days of the week have different numbers of classes. Again, that doesn't matter. If you are taking class that's just Monday, it doesn't matter that Martin Luther King and President's Weekend are all Mondays, it doesn't matter. But when it's a Tuesday and Thursday, you're trying to do the same thing. So I admit it right there. We are cutting the February 10th class so that we can all stay on target. Okay. Talked around a lot of stuff. Let's talk directly about the book, first of all. I've already had quite a few people write to me about the fact that Beecham and Childress, as they do every few years, have put out another edition, yet again, of Principles of Biomedical Ethics. So though I thought I was completely on top of their publication history, I put down and ordered the fifth edition, and there is now the sixth edition. That doesn't matter. Some of you will get the third edition and the fourth edition. And when it comes time, the very last week of the semester, when we read this pieces of this book, I will hand out the pagination for every edition you would have been born during its publication time. We're going to leave out the first edition, where many of you were not born, and Penn doesn't even have it in the archives. So, but I will paginate all of the editions so you can stop writing me, you can rest assured, you can buy any book you'd like. You need not buy it at the Penn Bookstore. It's the independent bookstore that tries to compete with the Barnes & Noble on 36th and Walnut. You can feel sorry for the Penn Bookstore and try to keep them in business, or you could just go with the giant Amazon, and they'll have a used copy for a fraction of the price. But you check your morals and get back to me on what you think you ought to do on that. And you can see you got mail beforehand. Oh my God, you have not seen You Got Mail, so you don't know what I'm talking about. Fox, F-O-X, whatever. Okay, so I have small children. They're 8 and 9. I haven't seen any films since they were born in 2001 and 2002, so all the movie references are before that. They're from the 20th century, so sorry. Okay, I don't care about the book, like I said. I'm only using it 1 week, but I really believe that it's good to have on your shelf. If you don't want to pay $35, like I said, there's lots of ways to get it used. but it's one of the books that if you take a class in bioethics, you ought to have on your shelf. One of the very few. If there's one book everyone in bioethics has, it's going to be that book. And that can probably not be said of any other book, including the Penn Center Guide for Bioethics, which should be on everybody's bookshelf. We're the authors of the Penn Center Guide to Bioethics, obviously. And you should definitely get a copy of that at Amazon.com. It's 20% off. You could just photocopy the pages from a library edition. It's up to you. The pagination is given. Up to you. All right. Let's talk about the written work for a second. There are two take-home exams. And I know that sounds very odd, just even to talk about exams in the context of a humanities kind of class. And it does sound a little, you know, sophomoric. But as I said, this is the class where mastery of a certain knowledge base is what we're trying to do. And so the take-home exam gives you a little bit of room to apply what we've done in the first half of the class, but three-fourths of it is really demonstrating that you really have mastery of what we're doing in the first half of the class. Because it is exam-like, it is open note, open book, open friend. There's no, I mean, I don't want people quoting Kant without quotation marks, thank you. But it is absolutely a, we're all here, let's master the material. And as some of you already know about this program, we are not actually confined to giving out only a certain percentage of A's. We can give out 100% A's. I've done it plenty of times. So I am thrilled when you all get A's. And if that means you chat with your friends to understand the material, go and do. That's great. The other thing is, the material is difficult, and that's part of why you are taking a class and buying somebody's expertise to walk you through it. But I will do a review session as well about the material, and you'll actually have the exam in front of you when we do the review session. You know, it's not one of those review sessions, and then it'll be a mystery what happens on the exam. You'll actually have the exam in front of you when we do the review session. Again, because you can't fake understanding this material. So it's all good that you're asking questions about what the material is, because the point is to really get a handle on it. Okay. It's about an 8-page exam when it all gets done. It is supposed to be in prose, so it's not supposed to be Blue Book-esque. It's supposed to look like an essay. It'll be 3 or 4 essays. And they're essay questions, and I lead you through them by the way that I describe what is being asked. And the final is quite similar. It's got a little bit more flexibility, but it's also on the material in the second half of the class. You'll notice that the assignment is due in a range of dates. That's because 17th to the 22nd is when the Tuesday and the Thursday class will hit the same week. So what that means, basically, is it's due on the 22nd of March. Let's talk about the phrase due on the 22nd of March. Everything about this program, as I've said, is flexibility. So when I say that something is due, I have a certain meaning that I'm ascribing to that, but what I am not meaning is hand in or else, and I'm not saying hand in or be penalized. Due means hand it in if you want to get it back quickly. That's what it means. Hand it back if you want to get it in quickly. Back. Hand it in to me if you want it back quickly. I try to keep myself to a 2 to 3 week turnaround. Depends on how big the class is. But let's say I can get it back to you in 2 weeks if you hand it on time. If you don't hand it in on time, which means basically 3 o'clock on March 22nd, you could be waiting a very long time to get it back, not out of spite, but because by then, where by the time you hand it back in, I'm already onto something else, I map out certain days for grading, and if you've missed what we call the grading frenzy, then you have to wait for the next grading frenzy, except the next grading frenzy is the final exam, and those people have already handed in the midterm, so they've got to have their grades by graduation, so you get to be the bottom of that pile, and it can go on and on. It doesn't matter, because in the end, if you don't get the midterm back, then it doesn't matter that you hand the final on time, because you won't be able to get the grade in the class on time, and that means you'll get an incomplete. And so what does that mean? An incomplete at Penn doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that you will not get a good grade when you have all the work in and I've graded it all. It just means temporarily you've not completed the class. That's all it means. It doesn't carry any stigma. It doesn't have any hidden penalty. The I will be erased. I will say work submitted. I'll put in a grade and no one will ever know there was an incomplete there, so it doesn't matter. In what circumstances does it matter? It matters if you're a 3L, for example, right now, third year of law school, and you have to have your grades in by May 9th, because then you will not graduate. So it matters in that sense. It matters if you're a fourth year medical student, because the registrar over there will not let you out unless your bioethics classes are done. If you're applying to something that needs a full transcript the day of the semester ends, it matters. And in no other case does it matter. So let's talk about how late can you be? If you want to be as late as you could desire, how late could you be? Well, you have to finish the program within 7 years. So counting back, you know, you certainly have the grace period of 2 to 3 years to hand it in. And I have had people hand their conceptual foundations papers in 2 to 3 years afterwards. And I have no problem with that unless they plagiarize. And that wasn't even a conceptual foundation. Yeah, it was. It was, yeah, right. Of course, because Kant's only in conceptual foundations, right. The lateness doesn't matter from my end, from a penalty perspective. It never matters. It'll never be a penalty. But here's what is true about conceptual foundations. After 2 years goes by, no matter how well you understood Kant in 2008, by 2011 you will have forgotten. And so you basically have to go back and listen to the whole thing again, because otherwise you can't do the midterm, especially the midterm. So a little bit late doesn't matter to either one of us. A lot late doesn't matter at all to me, but it could be a real pain to you. And I've actually had people take the class again, not pay, but sit in an entire second time. I actually had one woman do it 3 times because she just kept thinking she was going to get that midterm done. So she started in like 2003, and then she tried it again in 2007, and I'm happy to say she did finish it in 2010. But, you know, if you want to avoid that, then don't be that late to the point where you've forgotten what's actually on the syllabus. I'm joking, but obviously these are real anecdotes. So now, because there is no penalty for being late, I don't care that it's going to be late. In fact, I care that you tell me it's going to be late. I care that you absolutely don't tell me that it's going to be late. Don't tell me. Don't tell me, don't ask, don't request, because it doesn't matter. Just don't hand it in. And from the fact that you didn't hand it in, I'm going to know it's late, right? So I don't need any extra information about that, and you don't need any extra permission. You have my permission. Hand it in when you want, whenever you want, whatever year you want, whatever semester you want. Done. Okay, and so you understand that if you don't hand the midterm in on time, you probably won't get the final done in time. If you do hand the midterm in on time and you don't hand the final in on time, then you're probably looking at a summer complete date. But that's all up to you. The same rules apply for the final, except that there's no range of dates. It's May 5th, 3 o'clock. 3:10, it's late. Doesn't matter, but I've got a grading frenzy on May 5th because I've got to get everybody's grade in before graduation, and there's a very small window in the spring. So at 3:10, it will be on the late pile and it'll get done in August. So definitely want to get that done in time if you want the grade. All papers to Robin. Okay, let me stop for a second and see what we have and have not thought of here from the sort of logistics and nitty-gritty. Can you think of stuff? You can snack lightly or heavily. I do sometimes feel that tuna casserole isn't the best thing to bring. I was actually, and this has not happened in conceptual foundations, but the new Neuroethics Society, Martha Farah Center, has a course that she taped, and it's now an online class, but she had me do 2 guest lectures, and I am not kidding you. Whatever was in that nasty Tupperware while I was giving the lecture was torturous. But absolutely, you can eat as much as you want, and you can drink as much as you want, and if you cannot eat tuna, then, you know, that's just a bonus for us all. Of course you can eat. Absolutely. I'm surprised you have to ask that question, but I guess some people are like, no, you can't eat. It's 4:30 to 6:30. Of course you're hungry.
It says paper, but that means the exam.
Yes, because from now on, we're never going to talk about it as an exam again. Because I want it to look like a paper. I want it to have capitals. I want it to have periods, paragraphs. I want it to be double spaced, typed. So I want it to be a paper. It's just not a paper of your choice. It's a paper of my choice with questions. What does Kant mean by the such and such? It's going to be very directed, but I want you to smooth it out so that it actually flows one paragraph to another. So from now, henceforward, we're going to call it a paper. Yes, two of them, midterm and final.
Can we go back to the colloquium dates just for a second?
Please do.
For example, February the 15th, and if you have a conflicting class on the 15th, you miss the colloquium, correct?
Are you taking a class somewhere else?
Here.
Oh, no, that's here. That's not somewhere else.
Okay, well,
all our classes come together for the colloquium.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right.
So who must you mean? Don't tell me. Lance.
Your associate that you just raised off the wall.
You're going to have to tell him that, right?
He
will not
so
laugh.
So basically, it's no Thursday. Okay.
Lance and I will have all of our classes together here. It's always like that.
Okay.
We would never run a colloquium and let Lance go talk over there. Right here. In fact, Nora sends out the Riot Act email to all instructors saying there will be no classes on right.
Just curious of the topics for the program.
Oh, well, if John Robertson and Cindy Patton don't have them on there, then that means they haven't told us yet.
Okay.
But I can tell you that Cindy Patton is a queer theorist with a PhD in communication, and I'm pretty sure she's going to talk about pornography. Yes, she's actually going to talk about gay male pornography, and I think she's going to go so far as to talk about barebacking, so I would be here, for sure. I think that John Robertson is going to talk about, he's a legal scholar, he does legal bioethics, so he's going to talk about something in the vein of bioethics and the law, and that's because I thought bioethics and the law was on Tuesday when I did the colloquium. But John Merce didn't want to be on Tuesday. So there you go. But it will be on something related to research ethics and the law or something. But he's, like I said, he's a policy guy. He was on Clinton's presidential commission. But the most important thing to note about the colloquium speakers is they're all really spectacular. Like, there can be a really famous person. I won't give names, like Pellegrino and stuff. And then they'll throw those names out and they'll say, oh, dull. And they don't get invited even though they're world class. So they have to be famous and interesting. Now, if he wanted to talk about barebacking, we'd let him come. But that's not what he would have talked about. So we said no to him. Okay, I know you had a question. Oh, it was about the colloquium. Were there other hands on this? Mm-hmm.
How do we access the Blackboard?
Very nice. Glad you're mentioning that, because for some of us now, Blackboard is just so part of our life. Even I've mastered it. But if you're new, okay. It used to be very easy to figure out how to get to Blackboard because it was accessible on Penn's homepage, and now it's actually embedded in the library. So I think the best thing to do when you're at the Penn Homes website, and then bookmark it, when you're at upenn.edu, up at the top is a little search on the site, not the Google, but here, write the word Blackboard in, and it'll take you right to it. And then you're going to come to a place where you need to log in. Two boxes, your Penn key and your Penn password. The Penn key is this misnomer, because of course it's not a key, it's your code. Usually it's your designation that you have on your email before you get to your whatever's next, mail, med, or nursing, or whatever. That thing right here is the Penn key, and then you have your password, and you get in. If you don't have a Penn key, you need to go to the home page, and down here where it says students, you need to click there and follow the link to get a Penn key so that you can access Blackboard. In the meantime, you can write to Nora Jones, who's my associate director, and you can find her easily on our website, and get access to Blackboard. And you definitely want to make sure that you have access to Blackboard. Next week, I will come in with a printout, once all the shoppers are in, with all the emails that are listed on Blackboard, and I'll run it around, and you'll be able to check to make sure yours is correct. but it is imperative that you get this thing called the pen key so you can get onto Blackboard, and everything is there. And of course, it's right to bring that up, because besides the book that we use on the very last week of class, which I basically just shred, the rest of the time, it's all articles on Blackboard. So the bulk packy thing of yesteryear is all gone. If you don't like to read stuff electronically, because you're not one of those Nook and Kindle-y people, then that same place that has the coffee and the tea has printers. So you can print out for free the readings for the week. So that is basically how you get to Blackboard.
Mm-hmm. Can I have one more?
You can have as many as you want. You're paying $4,500 for this class.
Well,
go ahead.
What about bad weather and snow?
I am told good. Thank you.
We'll sign in.
This is not sign in. Oh, this is how do I get you if I'm afraid of the ice? That's what this is. Penn never cancels class. You can call Penn 898-MELT to find out the information that they never cancel class, but they never cancel class, but we do. We do when Autumn is afraid that she cannot get back to Princeton on that evening of class. And that's the litmus test. She doesn't quite mean it literally, because sometimes I'm not teaching, because maybe it's a Wednesday. But the issue is, can the commuters get home? Not can the walkers walk and, you know, be chilly, but can the commuters get home? And if I feel like it's risky to the commuters, I will have us bail. And it usually happens once a semester. Last year with that crazy, it happened twice. Of course, Penn canceled twice, so you know that we were sort of right on, you know, on the same page there. 898 MELP had two cancellations last year, which is extraordinary, probably a record for them. So how do I find you? The first thing I do is send out a message through Blackboard. The second thing I do is put a message on BioE, through BioE Grad and BioE Alum. Then I put it on our website at MBE UPenn. And then I make sure the receptionist knows. But that, of course, is not enough, because many of you are not that whole iPhone, you know, BlackBerry 24/7. So you're going to give me one number or two if there's a possibility that I wouldn't be able to get you at the first number. And then we literally break this down through the secretaries and all the staff and the administrators, and we call every single person to make sure that we've hit them. And we make that call by 2:00. So I need you to put down in legible handwriting, not so we're doing like code breaking here, numbers that I can reach you, the first, and if I'll nail it on the first one, fine, and if not, a second number, so that I can make sure I call every person for that one time that it'll happen, probably, that the class will be canceled. And we will call everyone in the Tuesday and Thursday section on either a Tuesday or a Thursday section, because, of course, as I've just explained to you, the registration doesn't actually reflect whether you're going to come on that day, especially when it often happens that the Tuesday section maxes out just in terms of registration. It has nothing to do with who's actually here. So, yes, you will get a call from us by 2:00.
Mm-hmm. Can you just remind us, for those of us who are maybe looking at it, sitting in on a couple different classes, by when we need to decide which class we're taking?
Yes, though obviously you should take this one. you can add up to 2 weeks. You can drop up to 5.
2 weeks from today?
2 weeks from yesterday.
Okay.
2 weeks from yesterday. But actually, if you've been attending right along, Nora can make magic. She can add after. What is critical is that you don't drop after, because then you get billed. So you get, it's a 2-5-10 system. 2 weeks to add, 5 weeks to drop, 10 weeks to withdraw. Though withdrawing is an absolute bad decision, because you still pay and you don't get any fun. So withdraw, just forget. So 2 weeks to add, 5 weeks to drop. But she can add you after that. And the drop is serious, because that's when the penalty starts. All right, what else? Mm-hmm.
If you're asking this question, because I came in late, so I imagine you covered it already.
But I don't mind people coming in late. So I don't, and if you come in late, of course you might ask a question because you weren't here. So I'm not mad. Go ahead.
So I was just curious as to what the general format will be of this class in terms of, will it be mostly lecture? Will it be there?
Oh, I haven't said that yet. Okay. Bad news, but luckily you can still shop other classes. It's the all me show, because this material is, I have a PhD in philosophy and this stuff's almost unreadable without it. So what happens is I go talk, and then you raise your hand and I say, yes, absolutely, tell me. I don't quite understand what you're saying. Okay, and then I talk, and then you interrupt me. So it's interrupted lecture. It is rarely discussion. because we're not trying to debate whether one ought to be pro or anti-stem cell. We're trying to understand if you are anti-stem cell as a deontologist, what would you argue? And if you are anti-stem cell as a consequentialist, what would you argue? So to me, I don't care whether you are or you aren't. The question is, how would you go about arguing it? So what I'm trying to do is give you the tools so that when you go into every other class, you can argue effectively with these tools. And for that, discussion amongst each other. I mean, unless it's going to be an exegetical question. No, I think that Kant really is saying with the second formula, the categorical imperative, we're unlikely to have that. So mostly it's you asking questions and me answering them after I talk. Nonstop. But the nice thing is, if you like hearing people talk, I talk so fast that I really get about 4 hours worth of stuff in the 2 hours. So it's a bargain, really. But yes, that's the style of it. And there is no other... there's no other person who does that to you. It is only me. Every other class would be a discussion. Yeah, it's very unusual. And no other class would do an exam, for heaven's sake. So this is one of the two required classes, and that's because my obligation is to get everyone who's doing the master's program on the exact same level playing field. And how are we gonna do that when we've got med students and doctors and law students and lawyers and nursing students and nurses and dentists and veterinarians? We come from so many walks of life in terms of professional training that we have to have some courses where we're going to all be able to have a similar tool set. So that is a great question, and that's the answer to it. Okay, what else before we do? Really? No other questions about this whole thing? It's online. I think it's pretty much covered. What you're going to notice about this class is that there's only a tiny bit of reading. Sometimes there's only like 10 pages for the week. I should say another thing about the reading. What is the reading likely like if there's only 10 pages of it, right? It's probably fairly brutal. You should expect, if you don't have a philosophy background, that you might come in having understood not one word of what you read in those 10 pages. It might be like a total wash for you. That's fine, because what I want to know is, how much do you understand when you walk out? That's why I do all the talking. So my job is to get you from complete confusion and oh my God, to, you know that Kant guy, he's not so bad. I'm feeling him. So you are going to notice difficult reading, little of it. Many times you're going to read it a second time and with a completely different light, but it's rich and it's worth that second read if you decide that you want to do that. Either way, my job is to get it clear to you. That's what I'm supposed to do. So it is not your job to have it be comprehensible the first time and to understand it. It's my job to make sure you have mastery of it before you leave. And what that'll mean is that, of course, you're here or you're listening to it on tape, but that you ask the questions you need to ask as we're going through and you don't let confusion just happen. That you're actually feeling responsible, accountable to your own knowing and making sure that you do interrupt me when we're walking through some of this tough stuff and you have questions. Questions are always welcome. If we get to a point where I feel like I'm not going to be able to convey it, sometimes there are just concepts that we'll just have a block to, then I might table it and say, We should talk afterwards. We need to meet, and I'll be able to get this across to you, but I don't want to take class time to do it. But we're permanent here with lands. The blue is obviously a bad idea. Okay. So that is, I think, all I need to say about the readings and about the length and the density of them. All right. So that's going to turn us then to looking at the syllabus topically and me giving you a little primer, let's say, about the main theoretical camps that we're going to look at in this class. Today there was no reading for. And then we start down the path of the two main frameworks in moral philosophy, and actually I want to say even broader than that, in moral reasoning itself, consequentialism and deontology. These, I'm going to argue, following most philosophers in the world, are the two ways that people reason when they are working through a moral problem. ought we to have stem cell, ought I to cheat on my partner, should I plagiarize that comp text, how much money should I give to charity, have I given enough to charity, should I allow my grandmother to have her ventilator withdrawn, the whole gamut. I'm going to argue people reason from one of two perspectives. Neither perspective commits you to any particular moral commitment. This is a method of getting to an answer. It doesn't tell you which answer you get to. So you could be pro-choice and pro-life, the ontologist. Pro-choice, pro-life, consequentialist. These are ways of getting to an answer. They're not political positions. And to illustrate that for you, let me tell you that I am a deontologist, and Art Kaplan is a consequentialist. And I like to lay that right out, because I run through this entire class knowing that half of you are consequentialists and half of you are deontologists, and you might be in the respectable Art Kaplan side or you might be in my side, and it doesn't make any difference. Knowing who I am, knowing who he is, knowing who you are, is all enhancing. It's not one of those classes where, you know, they don't want to tell you that they're actually a huge right-winger because they want you to make up your own mind. Of course I want you to make up your own mind, but here's the thing, your mind's already made up. You're already a deontologist or a consequentialist. One of these two frameworks is going to resonate with the way that you already think. So why should I pretend that I'm not a one thing or the other? It helps you, because I'm able to say, here are the Achilles heels. This is where deontology gets hinky. This is where consequentialist really has it over us. And I can say, too, here's where you might have a real run for the money from a deontologist on this particular thing. So I'm just telling you straight out, and I've already named two people, both at the center, who hold these views, so you know that you're not, it's not like, well, all the smart people are over here, and, right? You can be famous and smart over here, and rich, actually, why not? Okay, so another thing I want to tell you is I like to use me in art, because Art and I agree on almost everything. In fact, I'm going to say everything, and maybe you'll come up with something that we don't agree on. We agree on everything, on political candidates, on should you have organ donors with babies born with an encephalic, you know, brain. We agree on everything, but we don't get there the same way. And so, I'm trying to make the point here that we are talking about the way that people arrive at their moral decisions, not the moral decisions they actually arrive at. And yet, knowing that makes me able to say, okay, here's how his argument on some position might be enhanced by this particular argument he would not have access to. Or here's how I'm vulnerable to a particular charge that someone on this camp might make against me and that I will have to protect myself against. There are so many reasons why we need to understand which camp we're from. When we're analyzing moral argumentation, it strengthens the way that you understand the positions you take, and it strengthens the way that it strengthens your ability to analyze and recognize the arguments that other people make. It makes you more effective knowing this framework. That's why you're here all semester. Knowing this framework helps you build better arguments, and it helps you defend or attack arguments better. So that is why you want to do it. Arguments will make sense. They'll jump out at you in relief. We often don't have people come up and give sort of testimonials of, oh, now that I understand, I see this argument and it's such. This will give you a lens that you prior to this class did not have. And that will be very strengthening when it's time for you to write papers in it, papers or arguments or even solving ethical dilemmas in the work that you do. Alrighty, the structure here for looking at these two camps will be that we look at a theory, a very theoretical form of the of this particular perspective, and then we will, get, and that's from the classical iteration of it, that is back in the day. So for consequentialism, we'll look at Mill. Then we'll look at a modern day version, theory, again, staying with theory, but now from a contemporary philosopher. In this case, we'll be doing Philip Pettit, who is at Princeton. And then we will do a piece that is applied so that you can actually see consequentialism or whatever, deontology, on the ground. And for that, we're going to use Peter Singer. And that's how we're going to think through consequentialism. So we first understand it in its most theoretical, then in its modern day theory, and then applied. And we'll do the same thing for deontology. And you can see that that will actually take us to the end of February, beginning of March. This is the first few weeks of the class, the first 6 weeks, and we will be thinking about day-to-day morality, micro-morality, everyday morality, the kind of the kind of dilemmas you face in your life or in your work, through your profession, at the individual level. It's about individuals and the moral choices that they are called upon to make. That's the first 6 weeks. And then we're going to look, so first at the individual level, and then we're going to look at the political for both consequentialism and deontology. And actually, we're not going to do a whole lot with consequentialism at the political level. I'm going to tell you about why. But the idea will be that we spend the first 6 weeks looking at how each individuals make moral decisions. And then we're going to look at the political theory. How ought societies to be governed politically in the aggregate? Not the individual anymore, but at the aggregate. And the reason that's relevant for bioethics is because aggregate morality, macro morality, is where you get things like rationing. Rationing is a macro decision. We often think that, for example, organ rationing or triage, those are public health or other institutional decisions that are not made based on two individuals interacting, but they are applied from a decision we've made at the aggregate. Like, how do we triage? We don't decide that based on an individual case. We just see whether the individual case follows the rule of triage that we've come up with. That's aggregate morality. It may not be considered political quite, but political theory, political versions of deontology or consequentialism help us understand aggregate morality. How instead of individuals interacting and what ought they to do, we're thinking about groups. And so it gets very relevant, the political gets very relevant when it comes to things like insurance coverage, access to healthcare coverage, or as I said, rationing of some version or the other. We aren't going to have to spend a lot of time on the aggregate or political version of consequentialism, because consequentialism has the great advantage of being the exact same theory, whether it's at the individual level or whether it's at the aggregate level. It's a streamlined, very elegant theory that doesn't require any kind of gymnastics to move from individuals to the aggregate. And so we won't have to have a dedicated week to consequentialism in the aggregate. We'll be able to talk about it knowing just from these 3 weeks what consequentialism looks like in the aggregate for rationing or for healthcare access. The deontology is very complicated, and complicated doesn't necessarily mean true or right, but no one will ever accuse deontology of being simple and streamlined. It's not. Its founding father here in the classical iteration is Kant. Its modern day theorist that I'm going to use is Barbara Herman. She's the chair of the UCLA philosophy department. She's absolutely impenetrable. And then we'll do an applied piece. But the point is that deontology is very convoluted in structure. I think it's true, but so what? It certainly doesn't have elegance and simplicity as one of its virtues, for sure not. And when it gets to the political level, it doesn't look anything like it looks at the individual level, so we will be reading John Rawls at the political level, because he is the most famous, his book called The Theory of Justice, is the most famous articulation of the deontological at the aggregate. And, so what? When there are deontologists in bioethics who think at the aggregate level, they use Rawls, so like Norm Daniels. So the famous folks in bioethics who do deontological theory at the aggregate use John Rawls. And so that's who we'll be doing. Now, if you look at this syllabus, you're going to see that we have consequentialism and then deontology. And then we have, still in part one, something that is called virtue theory. Let's see, I'm not going to erase. I'm not even going to put a straight line. I'm going to put a dotted line to virtue theory. Virtue theory is the descendant of Aristotle. As Bentham and Mill founded utilitarianism, consequentialism, I'll use those as synonyms, as Kant founded deontology, Aristotle founded virtue theory long, long, long ago. In the 1980s and early 1990s, virtue theory was thought to be a third path, a third framework. And there was a lot of energy in the world of moral philosophy to think through that challenge to deontology and consequentialism, that there was really a third way. And now in the 21st century, I like saying that, we've come to believe that virtue theory is actually a subset of deontology. And that's how I'm going to argue it. So I am going to talk about Aristotle and his lineage, and I am going to argue it adds an essential deepening and richening of deontology, but I'm going to argue it is not a third way. It has both an individual instantiation and a political level, and they don't look alike, and so we'll do that too. We will do virtue theory at the individual level using a piece about abortion, and I will argue that without virtue theory, deontology looks rigid and wooden and shallow. With the marriage of deontology and virtue theory, I think you get a much deeper Kant. At the political level, it looks radically different than deontology. And there, at the political level, virtue theory really does become a separate thing. And it's called, you've probably heard this term, communitarianism. Virtue theory's political arm is called communitarianism. And the reason we're thinking about it is not because the world is flooded with communitarians. It's because very famous bioethicists are communitarians. For example, Zeke Emanuel at the NIH is a communitarian. Card carrying. And Mark Koscheski, who is the head, the president right now of the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities, is a communitarian. Very famous bioethicists are communitarians. In the world of moral philosophy, proper, that it not proper as if bioethics isn't proper, let's say non-applied, there aren't really a lot of communitarians left. They've all died. They've become, you know, something else, I don't know. Or they've retired. But in bioethics, communitarianism is alive and thriving. And so we are going to have a week to think about what communitarianism looks like when it comes to things like healthcare access or rationing, because it looks very different than the deontological instantiation of the political in John Rawls. Very different theories. In fact, if the communitarians hate one group more than anyone else, it would be the Rawlsians, even though I believe they can both trace up to deontology. Deontology thinks that its arch enemy is consequentialism. Communitarianism thinks its arch enemy is John Rawls and liberalism, and we'll talk about what liberalism means. That takes us then through March 22nd and the first paper. Okay, I haven't told you what deontology and consequentialism mean, and I'm going to. But first, I just want to give you the overview of the class. Okay. With that behind us, we're going to go into the second half of the class, where we're going to look at what bioethics has either created or resurrected. What do I mean by resurrected? Casuistry. Casuistry is a theory that was, or a camp, an approach, a method, which I actually think has a lot of value, a lot of merit. It was originally spawned from Aristotle and Aristotle's attention to the particular and the nuanced and the very contextualized nature of morality. In fact, Aristotle has a famous phrase, doing right, moral, doing the right thing, is doing the right thing at the right time for the right reason. No overarching principle can encapsulate the right thing at that time, because we don't know which principle should actually be in play in a particular moment, and you'll get to hear a lot more about that. But casuistry is a method that is case-based, looks analogous to legal reasoning in the United States, very, very similar to legal precedent, very old form of moral reasoning that, as I said, started right after Aristotle in the Hellenistic period, and then it really gained favor all the way up through the 17th century, especially in the Middle Ages, through the what we now call the Catholic Church. There was a lot of casuistical analysis in theology, and then it really peaked in the 16th, 17th century, where it fell into absolute disrepute. Why? Because it sort of got ahead of itself. it started to get overconfident that it wasn't a method and an approach to looking at a moral problem, but it could actually deliver answers about particular things. So you would have one answer, is adultery allowed in this case? Well, what's the case? And it would get very, very specific. Well, the one spouse treated the other one in this way and was married to the second cousin once removed, but then the had stolen something. And it got so detailed, and at the end, the writer would give some verdict about whether the action had been right or wrong, and then they would put it into these large tomes, basically, of volumes, where if you wanted to know if adultery in your particular case was going to be something problematic and how problematic, you could kind of look it up. Well, it was never intended for that, and so it fell into such ill repute, such disfavor in philosophy, that it was it almost became the four-letter word of philosophy for 300 years after. No one would touch casuistry with a 10-foot pole. And when you read Barbara Herman, the modern-day version of Kant, over here when we get to her, she'll actually use casuistry as a derogatory term because she's referring to this hubris that you could actually take individual circumstances and quantify them or reify them or name their moral rightness and wrongness and then make them into a volume, and that's what she's referring to. But bioethics sees in around 1980 or so that there's a lot of insight, a lot of good that comes from legal precedent, the way that the law uses it. And though the law does have that same vulnerability where it starts to have tomes of cases and you can go to all these case laws and all of that, and that's true, as a method of gleaning insight for a future case from a past case, there was something very appealing for bioethical problems, because bioethical dilemmas are very much, they're novel, they come out of, they might piggyback on other things we know about, but sometimes they take us into completely uncharted terrain where we really have no bearing, so to be able to anchor it to something else we know and fit it together like a jigsaw or a puzzle had some real advantages. So two people, Johnson and Tolman, wrote a book called The Abuse of Casuistry, and when you read that book, you'll only read a very tiny section here, you'll see what they mean is the past abuses and the future benefits. So many people consider casuistry to be the method of bioethics, as it is the method of legal reasoning, and I think there's actually a lot in it. Now, some casuists think that it's a method, it's a framework, it's one of these big things. I disagree. I think it's a tool that you use when you're a deontologist. I don't think you need it when you're a consequentialist, and you may or may disagree with me, we'll see, but I think as a deontologist, it actually makes a whole lot of sense, but it's a method and a toolbox. It is not actually a framework, and you'll get to make your own decision about that. So that is something that bioethics absolutely resurrected. In fact, in moral philosophy today, it's still completely dead, and in bioethics, it has quite a good reputation. And that's one of the strange places where bioethics and moral philosophy, even though they're closer than first cousins, they're actually siblings, really part company. But I have become convinced that casuistry has a lot to say. In fact, you're going to see me use casuistry in two papers the week after we do casuistry to show you what I think it would look like when you apply it. All right, two more things, and then we'll talk a little bit about the guts of these two theories, and then we'll adjourn. There is a class right now going on, Narrative and Bioethics, on Tuesday night. As we said, Lance Wehlert's teaching it. It's a great class. It's going to do a little of this, but of narrative theory. But one of the things that has become very popular in bioethics is the place of story in medical encounter or medical experience or even in medical practice. And one of the very famous bioethicists took the insights from narrative theory, from some of the understandings of what story could do and some of the structures of story, and argued that taking the insights from narrative theory and applying them to the way that clinical ethics is done gives us a great deal of insight about the foibles and the flaws and the shortcomings of clinical ethics cases and the harm that they do by the very way that they're written. So taking the insight of what story can do when it's done in a very elaborate and deep way, Todd Chambers takes those insights and applies them to the very thin and shallow case analysis that you get in clinical ethics to argue that we actually can harm patients by the very minimalist stories we tell in clinical ethics. And that's what we're going to do in that week. We're going to take Todd Chambers' book, The Fiction of Bioethics, and look at clinical ethics to see what his argument is about how we can very much backfire by thinking we're telling full stories when we actually aren't. And that's very bioethics. And the third thing we're going to do, and this is oddly placed, and if you know anything about this theory, you're going to tell me how, I don't know how to spell it. Nobody ever knows how to spell principalism. I don't know. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We'll have to see. But at any rate, principalism is an odd candidate for the very last week of bioethics. I place it there very much on purpose because I'm making a statement about principalism. And not maybe necessarily about principalism as a theory, but principalism in the bastardized way that it's practiced all across America in med schools and hospitals everywhere. And I'm going to argue, parallel to what Todd Chambers argues in his week on narrative theory, that principalism made shallow does a lot of harm, and that's why it's not going to be an accident that we read a paper called Why the Clinical Ethics We Teach Fails Patients. Because I'm basically going to argue that principalism in its shallow iteration does a lot more harm than good. Which is not the fault, necessarily, of Beecham and Childress. And I will argue that Beecham and Childress can best be understood as deontological theory, but when it gets parsed into the mantra that you all know and can recite, and I'm sure you can, autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, you know it as a mantra, when it gets mantrified, it loses every insight that we had from its history of deontology and become so shallow that it's got the same parallel problem to narrative theory, that it actually limits what you can see in clinical ethics dilemmas. That's why it's at the end, because I'm going to argue that maybe through no fault of their own, principalism is no longer used, is no longer understood as a theory. There is a principalist paradigm. It has become a method and a mode. And as such, I think it's very limiting. And it's made bioethicists feel like they see the whole when I think they see a part. And that will be the way that we end the class. So that is the structure of what we're going to do. I'll stop here for questions for a minute, and then I'm going to go on for a second, not too much longer, to talk you through what the meaning is of some of these big, at least for the first half, give you the overarching view of what some of these big theories entail. Questions? Okay, then we're just going to do a little bit looking at the shtick, the bottom line of these two theories, consequentialism and deontology. All right, eraser. You've heard me tonight slip between consequentialism and utilitarianism as if they were synonyms, as if you could exchange them and would have no loss of meaning. And that's not quite right. Let's make that a little bit clearer by thinking of it more as an umbrella. By the way, everything that I'm going to say from here out is the first 6 weeks of the class. So if you don't master it today, yay, then it's actually worth it to take the class. So this is really just the first pass. If everything is clear, hooray. If everything is not clear, we've got a lot of time to work through it. I'm really just trying to say it once. I'll say it multiple times, and by the end, it'll really absorb. Some of you are hearing it for the first time, and some of you have actually got quite a bit of experience here. So, okay, the umbrella term is consequentialism. And it means that the way that you decide whether something is right or wrong is based on the consequences. You want to know, ought you to betray a friend, you will say to yourself, on balance, do we get, and this is the phrase you'll hear over and over, the greatest good for the greatest number. by doing this action of betraying a friend or by not betraying a friend. You get the greatest good for the greatest number by doing action A, then it is morally right on consequentialist terms. That's the basic scaffolding of it. Right and wrong is not decided anchored by some kind of principle. One ought not to betray a friend. It depends. It will turn out to be the case, because obviously consequences follow in a certain kind of way. We are certain kinds of beings with certain ways of thriving and not thriving, that if we do certain actions, they will tend to not give us good outcomes. If, for example, you betray friends all the time, you will likely have the consequence that you will have no friends. So it is the case that a lot of things that consequentialists will ultimately argue are wrong will be the same exact things that deontologists argue are wrong. And yet, there may be a time when betraying a friend could actually produce more good than harm, all things considered, in a particular circumstance. You're not deciding based on the principle, don't betray. You're deciding based on all things considered, will there be more harm than good? On balance, do the consequences justify the action? Will we get the greatest good for the greatest number? So when you want to think about an action, you're going to think about its outcome. You're not going to measure it up against what you ought to do. There is no such thing. What you ought to do is what will give you the best consequences. Now, there are versions of consequentialism. All consequentialism is trying to maximize the good, the benefit, the whatever. But the whatever is what makes for different versions of consequentialism. So the most famous and the original was utilitarianism. And it will be what we read first. It's trying to maximize utility. Now, what's utility? In the 19th century, utility was a kind of what was useful to us, what was in the deepest sense useful and important for human beings. And the reason it got its name was because, metaphorically, utilitarians talked about how you'd get more utils doing action X than by not doing action X. You'd get fewer utils. And that was supposed to be a little quantity of good, quantity of utility. But what you're trying to maximize is utility. But you could be, for example, a welfare consequentialist. And then what you're trying to maximize is human welfare. And a welfare consequentialist will actually name what is it to have welfare. And for example, loving playing your guitar and feeling like having a great guitar is really, really important thing, and so you ought to do anything and everything to get that guitar so you can play, will not likely register high for a welfare consequentialist. They're going to be worried about stuff like food, shelter, water, medical care, UNICEF biscuits. They are not going to care that much about your pleasures that are fairly idiosyncratic or aesthetic or sexual or physical, unless it's substantial, like to survive. So you're going to see a difference between welfare consequentialist and hedonist consequentialist, where pleasures, all told, are actually going to be the currency that you're talking about, and you're going to be trying to maximize pleasure. Now, Mill is going to stop you right there, because I know where you're going, and he's going to say, do you want to live the life of the pig? Because if you don't, you don't want to be a swine, you better elevate a little bit more to what you just thought of when I said the word pleasure. Pleasure is going to even be the satisfaction you get by giving to charity. Pleasure is going to be pretty lofty in Mill's terms, though he's going to have his base too. But the point is, the hedonistic consequentialists aren't going to be just all pleasure all the time in our lay sense of pleasure. They're going to have a deeper, richer understanding of pleasure. Nevertheless, stuff's going to get counted in the hedonist version of consequentialism that's probably not going to get counted in the welfare consequentialist. And so when I use the word utilitarianism, it is the case that all utilitarians are consequentialists, but not all consequentialists are utilitarians. So I can use them interchangeably, and so can you, as long as we're careful. But what you're trying to maximize and get the most of changes depending on what kind of consequentialist you are. Okay, the bottom line for consequentialism is you are trying to maximize the greatest happiness for the greatest number. One of the questions will be, what number? the number of people in my family, the number of people in my profession, the number of people in my hospital, the number of people in my school, the number of people in the world. And consequentialism will have to wrestle a little bit with the parameters, not just in quantity of how many people do you consider, but also in the question of over what period of time. Because one of the things that will happen with consequentialism is that you can have something that is right now, because the outcome, all things considered, is better for doing action A over B, except 5 years from now, the circumstances change, and it turns out that that very thing you did actually caused a bunch of things you couldn't see, and that thing you thought was right turns out not to be right anymore, because the consequences actually were bad, you just couldn't foresee them. Yes, that's one of the Achilles heels of consequentialism, but each theory has its vulnerability. So deciding when you're going to put the parameters around what the time frame is for deciding whether something is right or wrong is going to be one of the sticking points, and different consequentialists will disagree about that. They'll also have to disagree at times about which outcomes are more important or which factors are more important. So much of this is going to be about probability, about guess, about whether you think this outcome is outweighing this other outcome. If you were with us in the fall, you did a paper on physician-assisted suicide where you tried to decide whether, on balance, the consequences of legalizing or not legalizing would be better. But everyone was asked to be a consequentialist in that paper, and everyone came down on different sides, right? I mean, some were for legalizing and some were not, and yet they were all using the same consequentialist approach. So obviously there's going to be differences in the way that you weigh and balance in consequentialism. What you're not going to do, though, is decide based on principles, on obligations, on moral considerations. In deontology, the key is to figure out what are the relevant moral considerations in a particular circumstance, and then decide of those moral considerations, obligations, principles, which governs. So you might have a circumstance where you are being asked to cheat on a friend, cheat on a lover, let's say. And then you would say, well, did I make a promise not to cheat, to be faithful? Or maybe I didn't. Maybe it's not called cheating, because maybe we don't have an exclusive relationship. So maybe I'm actually not cheating, because I never made a promise for which this would be a betrayal. That's the way that a deontologist would think through that question. And when the deontologist had decided, you know what, it would be a betrayal, well, then the answer is right there. One ought not to betray. Done. Or it would be cheating. Well, then it's obvious. You can't do it. No, it wouldn't be cheating. It would be just me, you know, serving my own interests but not violating yours because we had no agreement. Then I can. So deontologists look for the principle that's going to govern in the circumstance, and they make their action be in accordance and consistent with the principle, even if the consequences suck, even if the outcome is terrible. Deontologists are willing to bite the bullet that the outcomes might be worse for following the moral principles, for following their own moral obligations and duties, which is very difficult for the consequentialist to stomach, especially when you get to extreme cases where deontologists will say things like, but in principle, I object to this. Yes, but can't you agree that the world would be better off if we did such and such? But in principle, I can't do it. Well, then that is going to make for a difference in the worldview. So deontologists are going to decide whether an action is right or wrong based on whether it's consistent with a moral principle or a moral consideration or a moral obligation or a moral duty, and I'm going to use all of those interchangeably. Duty, obligation, consideration, principle.
Mm-hmm. Can those principles conflict the same way consequences would conflict?
Absolutely. In fact, there are many classic examples of principles conflicting. For example, one of the famous thought experiments or scenarios in philosophy is, this one's a little bit hard for us to get our head around it because wars aren't fought like this. You kind of have to go back to like Gladiator and think about Russell Crowe and how we can think very, very, very juicily on Russell Crowe. But I don't want that right now. What I want you to do is actually think about Russell Crowe in the context that he is called away from his family, which he very much values and cares about, to fight as a Roman soldier, I think. Obviously, I'm a little rusty on the details. He's not Roman, right? Okay, who cares? It doesn't matter. The point is
that
the...
Roman.
Huh?
He's Roman.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. It's been a long time. He is some kind of general or something. He's needed to defend his nation or whatever it is. But his family needs him at home. Think along that scenario, but make it worse. You are either going to be able to fight for your nation and leave your elderly mother, or in the time before there was anybody else to take care of your elderly mother, you will stay home and take care of your elderly mother, but your nation might not be defended. Okay. Maybe they'll lose, and who knows? A consequentialist will say, okay, we have certain kinds of outcome that would happen to the elderly mom, and we'd have certain kinds of outcomes that we, and that's certain. She'll die if you don't take care of her. But it'll be a probability of whether somebody could fight the war better, and we don't know how many people would die, and we'd have to calculate and we'd weigh in balance. On balance, would there be more harm or more good if we fought or didn't fight? But a deontologist will say there are two principles at stake. The obligation to care for my mother, that is my fiduciary obligation, my familial obligation. I am the only one who can take care of her. I have that obligation. On the other hand, I am a soldier or a general, and I have an obligation to my country, and I've taken an oath, and I have an honor to be honorable. I have a duty that I have to serve. And the deontologist is standing there then with two principles. Take care of the obligation to take care of my mother, and the obligation to fight for my country. And what does one do? Well, I don't know. That's the whole thing about moral life. No moral theory is going to tell you how to adjudicate between those two principles, as no moral theory is going to tell you on balance whether the consequences would be better if you fought or didn't fight. Once you understand what is going to be the thing you're deciding between and how you're going to be able to decide it, both theories are completely silent in terms of what the outcome is. Nobody can get you any further. My job is to help you understand what the principles are at stake or what the consequences would possibly be, and it's your job to weigh and balance the consequences or decide between the two principles. So both theories are often going to end up with choices that particular moral agents have to make. And oh, surprise, surprise, because we have moral disagreement in the world. So of course, if we have moral disagreement in the world, it has to come from someplace. Now, some people think that moral disagreement comes from relativism. This is not a class. This is the anti-relativism class. This couldn't be more anti-relativism. Anytime you're talking about these two theories and moral frameworks or whatever, you've already taken a stance that there is no such thing as relativism. There is moral difference. Relativism is not moral difference. Relativism means that you can't agree with me that there, if you're a deontologist, that there are two principles at stake. You don't know what I'm talking about. What do you mean? You're signed on to be a general and you think you have to go and fight because you promised. Or what do you mean you have to take care of your mother? That would be relativism. But you don't feel that way. You understand exactly what I'm talking about, that there are two principles. If you decide based on principles, you see those two principles. Moral difference is some of you think he should go to war and some of you think he should stay the hell home and take care of his mother. Either way, we've got difference, but we don't have relativism. Relativism means you can't agree on the stuff of which decisions are made. But we don't have that. I believe relativism is a complete myth. What we're really saying is we can have serious moral disagreement. Yes, but we can also have serious moral agreement, and oh, guess what? We do, most of the time. Most of the time in our lives, we don't have disagreement. Disagreement is noteworthy, newsworthy, because it's not every minute of our lives. Most of the time, we actually get along doing our, you know, either from a consequentialist or a deontological perspective, just if it's a consequentialist, following the rules that make for better consequences. If you're a deontologist, following the moral principles that we owe to each other. Either way, we walk through most of our lives not having moral disagreement, and that's why they're so newsworthy. Because now there's a break in the action. Now we have the conflict in principles. Most of the time we operate in a way that it's just all of our moral understandings operating and no coming to the front for a big dialogue. What we're going to talk about are the moments when we do have to bring it to the fore and we do have to look at it and think about how are we going to adjudicate, how are we going to decide. But relativism, if it were true, would mean that we would all be randomly living. You know, you'd walk into a place and they'd be like, I just feel like warming my hands in your stomach. I'm just going to slice you up and put your my hands in there. It's so freaking cold outside. Why not? No, those people we call sociopaths. We don't find them to be one of us. So that's another thing, and I'm going to end here. But one of the things we want to think about in this class is, one of the things we don't want to think in this class is to bring in the nuts, the crazies. Let the freaks be out there, because when we find them and they harm us, we put them in the mental institution and prisons and stuff. What we want to talk about is the moral reasoning of moral agents, the people who are not warming their hands inside other people's tummies. So we are going to leave all the crazies out there. I don't mean people, you know, I mean like sociopaths, the psychopaths, the people who don't have any moral reasoning, because they're outside the flock. Now, we can talk about how they got out there, and both consequentialism and deontology will have some stories about how you get that damage that you're not part of the flock. But what's interesting about moral reasoning for us as people in the flock of moral agents, people who are part of humanity, is that we do moral reasoning all the time. We are moral agents. So I chafe a little at the Martian examples and the sociopath examples. I'm already willing to admit they have no morality. They're amoral. They're outside the room. That's not relativism. That's serious psychopathology. So we're going to stay inside the room with all of our diverse views, of course. I want all people in the room who say to themselves, I am making a moral decision, even if that moral decision is diametrically opposed to your own. So I'm not trying to exclude based on whether I think their action is moral. I want to include based on whether they, when they define their action, they're saying, it is right that I did this.
So then does egoism fall into the craziness group, or does egoism have a place in one of these categories?
You know, the thing is, it's a name of a theory. What in our class we're going to do is try to find people who would actually operate like that. Like Nietzsche, he gives me a total pain in the, you know, in the ass, frankly, because he'll talk as if there's no morality, but he lives his life as if there is. You can talk a good game, but in the end, do you warm your hands up inside the tummies of people, or don't you? Because otherwise, it's just a lot of hot air. So I feel like folks with some of those views can spout off.